Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Ayn Rand stated that you cannot expect the unearned. Does that mean someone who inherits wealth from their parents and never has to work a day in their life or earn anything should feel guilty? Well, if you don't work a day as a matter of your life policy, then you are in the same position as people who mooch or loot, in the sense that you do nothing. You simply wait for someone to fulfill your needs and values. That is immoral. It's an abdication of your human status. It's an atrophy of your faculty of reason. And it's against all the objectivist virtues of independence, productiveness, and so on. But that does not mean that it's wrong to accept the unearned in the sense of the non-earned. Because in certain contexts, there's no problem at all. In fact, you would be irrational not to accept it. For instance, an inheritance. You may get a fortune. There's nothing wrong or no reason to feel guilty about that. You may even win the lottery. There's no reason to feel guilt that you have all that money just because it's, quote, not earned. It's not earned not in the sense that it's mooched or looted from other people, but in the sense that it was voluntarily given to you by those who possessed it. But the important point is not your getting it, but what you do with it. If you never then work, you never do anything, you just coast on the money that came in, that is a self-destructive form of life. You read my book, Opar, I have a whole discussion as that. Now, what money can do is enable you to change your form of production. For suppose you're a writer and you wanted to be a poet, and now the money comes in, you can change, you know, understandably, you don't need the kind of support. You can support yourself now on your inheritance and concentrate on work that doesn't bring in that much money. That's perfectly fine, but you still do something. I would be an example of that. I inherited a lot of money from Ayn Rand, but I didn't stop working, but I was able to do things that didn't pay enough to support me if I hadn't inherited. But I still worked, and not because I wanted to, because that gives life meaning. Did you ask Ayn Rand's opinion on your first book, The Ominous Parallels, before you published it? If so, why? That, I don't know how to answer that emphatically enough. I asked her advice from beginning to end. Now, she never gave me advice. I didn't ask her on what should my career be, or love life, or romance, or whatever. But I learned the craft, the art of thinking and of writing from her. She was an expert. She was a teacher. So it wasn't just I asked her opinion. You say in the rest of your question, which I didn't read, isn't that like Peter Keating asking Rourke for advice? No, Keating wanted advice on the course of his life. I wanted advice on how to write properly from someone who knew tremendous amount of writing that I didn't. So if you say, did I ask her opinion, that is a joke, because I showed her every single chapter when I finished it. And she marked up each chapter. She had lines in the margin where she liked it, a certain kind of lines, and certain kind of lines where she didn't, and very definitive marks when she hated something, such as BS in pencil in the margin. And I learned a tremendous amount from that, incalculable amount, to be so lucky. So if you call that asking advice, I certainly got it. But that is a pupil asking advice from a teacher. How does objectivism view procrastination? I'm a college student, but I find myself lacking the willpower to achieve an education. I know this is irrational. Do you have any advice? Well, I certainly lacked the willpower in college. I never procrastinated, or very rarely, in personal professional assignments. But things assigned to me in college, I procrastinated down to the last second, and in many cases, I simply got incompletes, which I had to make up the next semester. Now, of course, it depends what your estimate is, but the schools that I went to, I thought the teachers were awful, the system was awful, the teaching was awful, my fellow students were awful, the subjects were awful, all of it was awful. So I couldn't, it was almost impossible not to procrastinate, because then the only thing that I finally came down to was, if you don't do it, you're going to fail. So, okay, you have to do it. But certain things might help you if you're in a really bad, I mean, philosophically bad place. And usually the better university, the worse the place. I kept before my mind that my goal was not education, but PhD making possible the career. So, I could see a value in doing the papers, even if I thought the papers were ridiculous, because they were a step towards something that was of value to me. Education and the degree was zero. I never expected to learn anything at college, and I basically didn't, except when I went to school in Canada. But in the United States, in graduate school, I learned essentially nothing in 10 years. If you go there not expecting what you can't get, then you will not be in as much of a difficulty. Also, you can try this. You can try going in reverse. That is learning backwards, putting a negation before everything the professor says, and then you'll most of the time come out with the truth. And then you can figure out why he said what he said. Now, I may be giving you an overly jaundiced view, and some of you may have a better situation. But at that time, remember, there were no objectivists in the world at all. And it was a much more hostile, much more, infinitely more hostile atmosphere than you have today. I'm talking about the 1950s. Is it wrong to wish any time a news story about Hugo Chavez hits my newsfeed that cancer would kill him ASAP? Well, it's not wrong to wish on the destruction of anyone you consider thoroughly evil. But he is by no means at the top. There's a great, great many more people. If I were wishing, then I would start wishing for. By the time I got down to him, you know, they would have found a cure for cancer already. But I say there's nothing wrong with it, but it should be something momentary and, you know, peripheral that occurs to you, and then you shrug and go on. As opposed to, if it's something intense, and if it's something continuous, then you have a real problem, because wishing leads nowhere, and becoming that involved with a negative, which is completely outside of your realm of action, is a departure from reality. So it depends on whether it's a cursory, you know, like you say, I wish you were dead, and, you know, grinding your teeth week after week. For a while now, I have been trying to write fiction, but somehow it always feels painful to sit down to write. And when I finally do manage to urge myself into doing it, I always long to stop. But I love fiction. Why is it so hard? Well, I sympathize 100% with this question. I write nonfiction rather than fiction, but I have exactly the same situation. Writing was always painful. It was always, you could even say, agony, or most of the time. Many, many, many days, it was tremendous willpower even to get to the desk. I would just pace back and forth until I could finally force myself there. One of the problems was what Ayn Rand calls squirms. In other words, you have contradictory intentions, and you don't know that you have, and whatever you write is wrong, and you feel you just don't know where to go. Now, I would think that one of the reasons that writing is so hard is that it's purely conceptual. You have no perceptual guide to what the problem is or what the resolution is, as against like painting or music, where it can strike you directly. That chord is wrong. That color is wrong. The thing about writing is that there are so many choices. Almost seems like infinite choices. Do I include this or not? How long? Where? In what way? When I touch on it again, what part should go back and what part should go forward? And is this the right word? And so on. There are so many possibilities. And you do that largely through the subconscious to get your first drafts. Now, there are people, good writers, who don't have any such problems at all. They sit down, they have an idea, an outline, sort of, and then they just write continuously to the end, do maybe some minor editing. Some of them can do 3 or 4 good books a year. For instance, Isaac Asimov wrote something over 400 books in his lifetime. And I read 8 or 10, perfectly good. That's inconceivable to me. And apparently to the questioner also. But if you're stuck in the situation I was, this is the best advice I ever got. You can always write something, however bad it is. Write whatever you know or whatever you don't know, but just write. Get out of your subconscious whatever words are there, whatever way you can describe your confusion, whatever you want to include in any helter-skelter way at all. And then look at it and see how can you improve it, what could you answer, what can you add, etc., and then do it again. And what this person said to me is, it's not true that there's such a thing as writer's block. You can always write something. If you don't have expectations, that it must be good and it must be logical, it must be grammatical, just slop it out to get something on paper and then go from there to try and improve it. And I found that worked. Ever since then, I never had those periods of just staring at the blank paper without any idea of what to do. I just start typing. That's it. Where should you draw the line between trusting someone and taking something on faith? I have read many of Ayn Rand's books as well as yours, but I haven't read any books by Kant, Plato, Hegel, and so on. Everything Ayn Rand says makes sense, but am I taking her on faith when I adopt her view of these men? I would say, if you are saying, because she says these things, I am certain of what these men say, you would not be entitled to do that without any first-hand knowledge. But you can certainly say, on the basis of what you know about her, and, you know, the inner logic of what she says, that there's a very high probability that what she is saying is true, and that you haven't, in all your cultural observations, come across anything to contradict it. I would say, for certainty, you must read something about them, some decent commentator, at least, or summary. But the issue is the same. I used to tell classes in logic, you have to be independent. And they would say, well, when I go to the doctor, how am I independent? Aren't I taking him on faith? And of course, it's a matter of, do you choose your doctor according to his credentials, according to the patient's the qualifications judged by his patients, according to the logic of what he advocates? Then you're not taking him on faith. You're going by evidence that is available to you. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's 2 most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.